This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Everybody, and welcome to another edition of WrestleNomics Radio. I'm Brandon Thurston, broadcasting on demand from Buffalo, New York, where today is Sunday, August the 22nd, 2021. And today on the program, we have a lot to talk about. CM Punk is back in professional wrestling. It was SummerSlam weekend. SummerSlam attendance, AEW Rampage rating. We don't have it yet, but we have some clues about what it might be. All the other effects that the buzz around CM Punk has caused. TV ratings will review quarter hours for last week's Rampage and Dynamite. We have live events for the United Center, for Allegiant Stadium in Las Vegas for SummerSlam. Nick Khan making the media rounds. We have an entire Nick Khan section to go over in addition to a CM Punk section. A big week in WWE corporate. Nielsen came out with some interesting data about media consumption generally, and Paul Levesque did not do a media call, but he did address the media with questions about the tryout in Las Vegas only. All that and more today on the program, but first.
I think people talk about the shifting of what it is. It never really shifted. Right, so if you go back and you look at the hiring process, not hiring process of a television show, hiring process of who we were looking to train and make WWE superstars, right, long term. If you go back and you look at that, it hasn't shifted. It's been the same process.
When it comes down to it, CM Punk was not as good or as over as a John Cena. Wasn't as good or as over and moved the needle like The Rock. It just was what it was.
And you guys do have there is competition for WWE, sometimes there isn't. When I was writing about it, Turner had something called the WCW. Now there's something called the AEW. Do you have a sense of who is watching AEW versus WWE?
We had an earnings call a couple weeks ago, and I referenced the recent Reed Hastings line about sleep is our competition.
So I look at it like this. August 13th, 2005, I left professional wrestling. August 20th, 2021. I'm back.
And now, joining us from my immediate south. You know, I screwed up the cardinal directions last week. You were to my southwest. I said southeast. So retraction on that statement from last week when I was in Rhode Island. Now I am back in central west Buffalo, coming to us from my, I don't know, immediate south, maybe slightly southeast. No, yes, east. Chris Cullo joins us to talk about the week's events in professional wrestling. Did anything interesting happen this week, Chris Gallo?
A very, very busy week, indeed. And we'll just get off to it with the biggest news CM Punk debuted on AEW Rampage on Friday night to lead off the show.
He did. Yeah. Did you watch it?
I did. It was cool. Like,
yeah,
that crowd reception was cool.
Mm-hmm. It's the most I felt like a wrestling fan in a long time. I've told a couple of people. And maybe there's additional reasons for me with, Daniel Garcia, wrestling on the show in a big match with John Moxley. But yeah, I put my AirPods in and I, listened to the whole show closely to hear the crowd reactions. It was, it's been a while since pro wrestling has felt that much fun. I think there's a lot to unpack as far as CM Punk being a symbol for, and the Voice of Wrestling flagship may have talked about this quite a bit, but CM Punk being a symbol for a lot of the discontent that wrestling fans have felt, especially in the time between now and when he left WWE in early 2014. So much has happened, and it's been like really a whole era that his exit and return to pro wrestling or whatever, however you want to term it, as you just heard the clip there with him saying he's back in professional wrestling. But anyway, it sort of bookends this era of professional wrestling that began in 2014, the beginning of the network era, and this other era here where AEW continues to do some really interesting stuff, and the story of the business of pro wrestling, the most interesting story to me, and I think to a lot of people, judging by what our audience reacts to here, it is the story of AEW versus WWE, even though they are on dramatically different scales in many ways. I think what Punk meant as a symbol to people is, you know, the frustration that fans felt, secondarily, all of the sort of, I'm hesitant to say like injustices, might sound a little strong, but a lot of the unfairnesses and, the issues that WWE has with workers' rights, if you will, in terms of the classification of wrestlers as independent contractors, some of the medical treatment that he had that he was unhappy with. I really feel, if you go back and watch or listen to the Art of Wrestling podcast that he did I remember where I was when that came out, on Thanksgiving Day. I was doing the turkey trot in Buffalo. I did the turkey trot as I listened to it in, November 2014. And it's really just an amazing highlight reel of all of the issues and complaints that, fans and wrestlers have and would more so publicly have in the years to come. And I think part of the reason why there's an additional interest in the AEW versus WWE story, the fan discontent, a lot of fans feeling unsatisfied with the WWE core product. But also at the same time, WWE has made more and more money while putting out a product that many people feel is worse and worse. And it's insane to a lot of people that WWE can put out this product that makes them more and more money over time. I occasionally have people who, when I dare to have, an opinion about the WWE product, which I think is ultimately important to our topic of when we discuss the business of pro wrestling, the quality of your product matters. And people will tell me, well, if you think it's so bad, look at your spreadsheets, pal. They're making more and more money. So what are you talking about? And the reason why WWE is making more and more money is largely for external reasons. As we'll get into here, there's some internal things happening on the corporate side that, people like Nick Khan are doing to help WWE make incrementally more revenue. And he's facilitating good media deals for the company and already has, but that's despite the quality of WWE's content, not because of it. And WWE's media deals, I believe, would be even more valuable if the quality of their content was better, which I think it easily can be. And it's quite a contrast to watch. If you watched, as I suspect many people who are listening did, if you watched AEW Rampage on Friday night, and then you sampled the epic WWE SummerSlam the following night, it's quite a contrast. We won't get into that here, but there are other podcasts for that. I think it's a big difference. And the reason why WWE is making more money over time is because of the external media economy that it is fortunate to find itself in, where live sports content has become exceedingly valuable in this media environment in a way that it was not in prior eras. And WWE is still popular enough, in fairness to them. They are still popular enough to justify those fees, but I think those fees could be much higher. So his return, Punk's return, sort of symbolizes excitement for fans, but I think for the story of, is WWE going to get even stronger competition, or somebody going to exceed WWE in popularity in some ways in the future? It feels like we're getting closer to that time. And you've got, in many ways, a spiritual leader like CM Punk coming back to join the opposing team. So one thing I want to mention, I have a huge rant here to go on, but feel free to interrupt me if you have any comments, Gallo. One thing I want to mention is, great example of, some of the issues that some fans have, with WWE, but it's also an example of why WrestleNomics matters. I want to talk about, for a moment, the WWE SummerSlam attendance, right? So we get, the number is announced, 51,326 people. They put out a press release to commemorate this as well. WrestleTix shows, 45,690 tickets distributed. So that's a difference of, what, somewhere around, over 5,000 there. For what it's worth, yeah, I know a lot of other sports leagues and live event promoters exaggerate their attendance too. And nobody cares about when the NFL exaggerates their attendance, or college football exaggerates their attendance, or the NBA, or the Pope, for that matter, exaggerates their attendance. But it matters to at least some wrestling fans, probably particularly the kinds of wrestling fans that listen to a podcast about the economics of professional wrestling. Because I think, it's the only objective facts that we have, to measure, wrestling with. The wins and losses are predetermined, and, often they're just based on the subjective opinion or whims of one person. And it's the only thing that we have to measure. And I think this is why, you know, the interest in the ratings was not what it is now in 2018, when the only real big TV shows, on cable TV were Raw and SmackDown, or broadcast for that matter. There wasn't anything on broadcast. Impact was wandering around somewhere on the Pursuit Channel. And there was a little interest in TV ratings. And now there's interest because people want to check the scoreboard. They want to see how close is it getting. So that stuff matters more to wrestling fans who are used to being basically lied to and, you know, having their intelligence insulted anyway. Perfect example. Last night, you've got, a promoted Sasha Banks versus Bianca Belair match promoted right up to the last moment. They're running the video package to hype this match that they know is not going to happen. But, you know, they think it's within their creative license to continue to do that. And, we're not going to get in. I don't think we need to get into the choices to return Becky Lynch in the way they did. But, that's a whole nother issue. But the WWE doesn't feel like it needs to be honest or forthcoming, or they could have said, you know, we don't know, if Sasha Banks is going to be able to make it. They could have said that on Friday on SmackDown. But, you know, there's this sort of, I think there's really this historical legacy of the tendency to, like, not be honest because that's what you've always done. And that's the truth. We can't tell them the truth, you know.
The mystery opponent.
This is why
real quick, the mystery opponent buzz probably would have done maybe even better business if they said on Friday Sasha Banks won't be there, but she'll have mystery opponent. Most people probably would have speculated Becky Lynch, but I think that would have drove more discussion on social media and probably more intrigue and interest.
And look, if they just didn't know whether or not she was going to be cleared in time or whatever, who knows what's going on with her or whatever, what her reason was that she couldn't be there. We don't know. But they could have said she's questionable for the spot. And if she's not there, though, we have an opponent in place for whatever, you know. But, this is just one example. That's a small one among a lot of others about why, yeah, WWE is this great, resurging business brand, but it is not a good consumer brand. I like to hit on these three points that your brand is determined by the quality of your products and services, the communication effectiveness and timeliness, that you're able to communicate from your company to your customers, and the leadership, and talent's behavior. And, the communication is the issue here on this one. Better ad rates, but, you know, they don't, do a great job, making wrestling fans feel like they can trust this company. But anyway, so there's those things. I think we talk about next what the, we don't know, we are recording on Sunday. We don't know what the Rampage number is. The final rating will come out Monday afternoon. Dave Meltzer has gone on his, we can pull this slide out here and I'll jump back to the ones I'm skipping ahead of. Dave Meltzer has reported on a Wrestling Observer newsletter or Wrestling Observer radio this morning that Rampage, why don't you read what he reported here according to, one Trevor Dame on Twitter.
All right. Dave on Wrestling Observer Radio. The Rampage rating based on the top 10 markets looks exceptional. Trev caveat that the complete ratings aren't known yet, and sometimes getting all the markets in can cause surprises. In the top 10 markets, Punk's debut Rampage was up 57% over the previous week in terms of households watching, and up to 50% in terms of 18 to 49.
So if we do the math here, Dave is saying 57% up in total viewership, that's P2+, 50% up in the key demo of 18 to 49. If we just do the math here, and this is assuming that if it were the case that these top 10 markets are representative of the nation overall, which is a big if, but let's do the math here and let's assume this for the sake of argument, that would mean that the total viewership from if, and we're talking about the difference between this week, this past Friday and the Friday before that, the debut of Rampage, that would mean 1.16 million viewers, 1.16 million viewers total. And that would mean a 50% increase on 1849 would mean a, 594,000 viewers in 1849. I'm giving into the demo ratings here now that Showbiz Daily is back here. I was trying to persuade everyone that they need to stop talking about demo ratings and start talking about viewers because that's what makes sense in everybody's brain. But Showbiz is back. And, I even had, one prominent person in the business, ask me for the demo rating after I gave them the viewer count in 1849. 0.46 would be the demo rating there if it was 50% higher than last week. 0.46 in the demo. That's a raw rating, roughly. That's what raw does lately, I believe. Let's double check that if the spreadsheet will react quickly. There's my scroller. If we scroll to the bottom of our WrestleNomics viewership spreadsheet that you can get access to through Patreon, patreon.com/WrestleNomics, or just $5 a month, along with my reports just about every weekday, the ratings reports and other stuff, 0.55 Raw did last week. So it's a little below what Raw is doing lately. When's the last time Raw? We had this record low on July 5th where they did 0.41. Week after that, the last week in the Thunderdome, they did 0.43. But they have been doing better than that ever since. So this would be just below what Raw is doing lately. If this is the case, we'll find out on Monday. Come to think of it, I should probably do a live stream or something on Monday because I'm sure there's going to be hysteria in reaction to this number, especially if it's this high. If it's over a million, I want to talk about too. I had these notes here because this tidbit from Dave just came out this morning. What I had here was, let's talk about what the different ranges of the result would be. Like if it was less than 800,000, that would be a disappointment. That means it would be no higher than week one of Rampage. But if it's in the 800,000s, okay, that's normal. That's within what I was expecting. Cause if we go here, I did some math here and, I'm like, well, I think the baseline for Rampage is probably about 20% lower than what they did in week one. So that would put it at just under 600,000 viewers total, about half in the demo. So to get from that theoretical baseline to a million viewers, you got to be up nearly 70%. And there isn't a lot of mathematical precedent for that. That's not something that happens really. Cause what I like to do is take the mean of the prior 4 weeks for a given episode and compare it, to the viewership for that episode. And there's like, one case where AEW did a 70% increase versus the median of the prior 4 weeks. And that's when, on July 30th, they just returned to the normal time slot. So an external factor, not an internal factor having something to do with the content of the show. And then on April 14th, they were up 67% in total viewership. That was the first episode after the end of the Wednesday Night War where they were up again 67%, not 70 though. This is all very theoretical, and we only have one data point to deal with here, which is week one of Rampage, to try to figure out what this means. If it's over a million, then when I was making my notes here, I wanted to say, well, that's really exceeding my expectations of what's possible. if it's like, and I wrote in a note here, if it, you know, greater than or equal to 1.1 million. And again, if these major markets, maybe, you know, in rural America or something, they don't care as much about what was happening on Rampage. But, this would be just over, you know, 1.1 million. And that begins to be, I'm so hesitant to be hyperbolic here and that I'm going to sound like I'm overhyping it. But then this is like a sign that there is something that is very much going to shake up the business of pro wrestling and the popularity of pro wrestling, perhaps. So there's that. I have some other things related to CM Punk and Rampage to talk about, but anything to add to that, Golo?
I'm really curious how many shows actually do over a million viewers after 10 o'clock at night on a Friday. Like, so that would be, I think, pretty amazing. I'm not sure what, like, Blue Bloods does on CBS or whatever, but, I don't know how many shows that probably do more than 1 million viewers after 10 o'clock, like, on a Friday night.
Mm. We could look it up. We could. Let's see if we can look this up quickly. Blue Bloods being your standard, which is a CBS.
I'm just program, thinking right? of a show that's been in that time slot for a long time, yeah.
Yeah. I think I have an uncle who lives in New York City who, like, works on the, I don't know, he, like, sets up the stage or the set for Blue Bloods.
I mean, so that probably does more than a million, but I don't know how many.
Oh, it definitely does. But it's mostly out of the demo. Did I scroll past the Friday? Yes, I did. There we go. We'll make this bigger too. So, everybody can see it. If we release this, maybe I will. So Blue Bloods 1.9 million at 10 o'clock. Dateline okay. 2.2 million at 10 o'clock. This is total viewership. But look, it's massive in P50 plus. Can you see this column here where they're showing the P50 plus share?
Oh, now I can see.
If we look at 18 to 49, SmackDown does from 8 to 10 on Fox, 0.58. But yeah, Blue Bloods in 18 to 49 does a 0.20. That's an NXT rating some weeks. Dateline does a 0.30, you know, an AEW number roughly. Some, I may be a lower end AEW number these days, but yeah. So there's that. Let's see here. If we go back to, here. So, we'll try to open this too. The numbers on YouTube for the CM Punk clips are in the multiple millions right now. But what does that mean in relation to, what AEW normally does on YouTube? I will open these links live on the air so we have the most up to date, numbers here to talk about. And I've got YouTube muted here, so hopefully it won't play into our ears here. And even if it does, people probably wouldn't hear it. But anyway, the most viewed YouTube video is the Orange Cassidy Kid, clip. 34 million views. Now, granted, that's a year old video, but 34 million views, for some context. 22 million views, 21 million views, 11 million views are the next most viewed YouTube clips. Quite a few that are over a million. So it's not like AEW never gets over a million. Again, these are not new videos. These are all videos that are over a year old, right? They all have the 1 year ago designation. Some are 8 months ago, 7 months ago. So if we look right now at what the CM Punk clips are doing on YouTube, as we struggle to open them on my, by the way, while we wait for this to load, I have ordered a PC, as I revealed on the live stream the other day. I've ordered a PC, that will, make our streaming capabilities greater. 4.4 million views for the entrance. And, for the other one, most of the PC is here, but I can't really start to assemble it until the case and the motherboard is here, but I can't really start to assemble it just yet. And, we'll have to see if I know what I'm doing. 3.8 million views on the, maybe this is the promo, I guess. So it's in two parts. It's the entrance, they go to commercial break, and they come back, and then he speaks on the microphone. So again, what is it? 3.8 million views and 4.4 million views. I wish we could look at all AEW video views within the first 7 days of the life of that video and compare this. That would be harder to find that data, though, without having access to AEW's YouTube analytics or something. So there's that. So that seems strong, but we don't have a great deal of context to put that in. The Google web search, though, for whatever it's worth, and let's talk about the United States here, but I looked at the worldwide too, and it was similar. There's a similar discrepancy. Last week, the first episode of Rampage, the Google web search related to AEW, and I think we talked about this last week, right? It was higher. The volume for AEW web search was higher on Friday than it was on Wednesday, even though Rampage was a more highly viewed show. But it was the debut, so if that was going to happen, that's not a shock that that would happen for Rampage on its debut. It was 1.7x over what it was on Wednesday. Okay, so just under doubling the Wednesday volume of web search. This Friday compared to this past Wednesday, 5.6x last I checked here. So that's a huge difference. And, you know, as I've said this on Twitter, I shared these line charts from Google Trends. I don't know what this means in terms of a rating, but it's encouraging. It's at least, it makes you feel that, well, it's not the case that last week, anybody who was going to be interested in seeing CM Punk return already was watching Rampage. There would be no, additional viewers there to capture. And these hints that we get from the top 10 markets that Dave is reporting, that's encouraging. We'll see what happens. See on Monday afternoon, 4 p.m. Eastern. Sometimes I get it a few minutes earlier. Scooping Chola's daily.
A couple other business notes from that. Pro Wrestling Tees, most t-shirts sold in 24 hours. The CM Punk debut tee. So much that they crashed his website again. And, I mean, they got it back up quickly. And then the ice cream bars, which I wanted to talk about. For some reason, the curiosity of me wanted to know more information about these ice cream bars. Where did they come from? How much were they? Because that's, you know, I'm guessing that they bought around 15,000. And that's a huge amount for a distribution order. I could not find the wholesale price, but I found the place where they bought them, and it's pretty cool ice cream bar. And it's actually like an ice cream shop in Chicago, which you can currently go buy the CM Punk ice cream bar if you were in Chicago or visiting Chicago for $5.75 a piece. Now, if you, at retail, and I know they didn't pay retail, they paid wholesale, but at retail, they gave out $86,250 worth of ice cream bars. My estimate. very small potatoes numbers, but.
That's not too bad. Yeah. Did you see that you can get so that's interesting. They're still selling it. So it's not as if this was the only time that this ice cream bar would be available. eBay, yesterday at least, I haven't looked today, has some pre-owned CM Punk ice cream bar wrappers that you can bid on, ice cream bar not included, for $61 was the high bid there.
Yeah,
on one of them. I just found that amusing that especially that these were designated pre-owned. Yeah,
nice. Some people are selling them in dry ice.
Really?
They're actually selling them. Yeah. Yes.
But how did they get? But it probably already melted though, right?
it probably didn't keep fake. Yeah. And by the way, the place selling them, it's just for pickup or in store only for $5.75 at Pretty Cool Ice Cream Bar in Chicago. Let's see here. Yeah, I know I saw.
While you're looking that up, the merch lines were really long by all accounts, to go get CM Punk's new t-shirt that he was wearing. I was told merch sales were stupendous. For whatever that means. But I imagine there was a high venue merch per capita. Usually for WWE pre-pandemic, it was $10 to $12 per head. When WWE was fully touring in North America, I would imagine it's quite a bit higher than that, for this occasion. Do you have something else there?
Trying to find this, here we go. Unopened, in the freezer, dry ice. $1,000. $1,000. Somebody selling one that's still intact.
That's
some are selling them unwrapped but melted for about $80.
Unwrapped.
And,
Wait. And unwrapped but melted. What is it, like in a Tupperware container? What are we talking about here?
Just says unopened CM Punk ice cream bar, new unwrapped AEW ice cream bar, but this one mentions nothing about it being shipped on dry ice or being still intact, where the other one said it would be still intact. So yes, I'm assuming this is an $80 melted ice cream bar. Wrestling merchandise, it's an all-time high.
Yes. Okay. I think that's Rampage for now. We could quickly go over some of the ratings that we have. I've discussed this on YouTube already. On Thursday evening, I did another live TV ratings talk on the WrestleNomics YouTube. And we would really appreciate it if you subscribe to WrestleNomics on YouTube. Check those out. I'll probably, as I was saying, maybe I'll do one Monday evening. But yeah. Here's the Gullah Report.
All right, yeah, so we'll just talk about Friday, August 13th SmackDown. That did a little over 2 million, 2.084 million with a 0.58 and the 18 to 49. Compare that to Raw from this week on August 16th. Did 1.857 with 0.55 and 18 to 49, and that was a little bit of a bump where it was 0.49, 18 to 49, and little under 1.8 million on August 9th. NXT, the go-home show for TakeOver, 654,000 with the 0.15 and 1849. That was down from 750,000, but and a 0.19 and 1849. So the buzz of being
really
back in USA after 2 weeks. Yeah.
Suggesting that the first, that the previous week was sort of a rubber neck effect of, I think related to the news of NXT turmoil, that people had NXT more top of mind and checked out the show that night.
Dynamite, all this buzz happened on what might be on Rampage. Well, they did 975,000, with a 0.35 and 18 and 49. That was down very slightly from the week before with 980,000 and as well as a 0.35 and 18 to 49. And Impact,
yeah, basically an equal number despite a stronger card. The number of the previous week was a little bit disappointing, but they were against the newly added challenge to the lineup. But same, very similar number here, basically equal in total viewership, same demo rating, but stronger lineup with MJF and Jericho in the main event, but same viewership.
And I can imagine they end up back over a million this week, my prediction. And then, for Impact, 126,000, with the P2+, 0.04 in 1849. Week before was 120,000 with a 0.04. And, just one other wrestling related program, Heels, which debuted, this past week, did 128,000 in 1849. It was a 0.02 rating with, 23,000 viewers. Now, keep that in mind that this was a show that they put on their streaming device before they actually aired it.
I've been told that it's on streaming. I've been told in my Twitter replies that this was also available streaming. I've heard.
But, the Impact I was actually watching it this morning.
Since June. Oh, is it good? I've heard there's a lot of talk about scripts.
There's some liberties of scripts. Yes. There's some scripts and stuff. Some of it's kind of real, but then so the indie wrestling in you and
it's
me.
It's about indie wrestlers, like right? Like they're that's the setting. They're indie wrestlers. Have you ever been handed a script in indie wrestling?
Absolutely not. By the way, he runs a weekly Sunday night wrestling show. Clearly, there's not an athletic commission he's dealing with. Cost
in Georgia, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're going back to Impact. I'm sorry, cut you out there.
Impact was just slightly over what it was last week, but this happened to be the highest one. Highest viewership since June. Maybe Christian driving some interest here, who won the Impact title, on the first Rampage. Yeah, let's think a little bit about Dynamite this week. Yeah, I agree. Over a million. Does it do better than whatever, let's say Rampage really is, you know, 1.1 million in change. Does it do better than that? There's so much I feel like I don't know here, and I did want to talk about the degree to which I don't really know what kind of draw. I've grown to hate that term because, I don't know, because you get so many people who are obviously just fans of such and such wrestler, and they want to talk about how such and such wrestler is a draw or the same thing in the negative. Have you listened to the Between the Sheets Patreon thing about the Summer of Punk 2011? Yeah. And they go over it, and I brought this up in the live stream on Thursday that, you know, if you look at the, Raw ratings in summer of 2011, they don't really react to the pipe bomb promo or to the Money in the Bank event in any abnormal positive way. It's pretty lukewarm results in the Raw ratings. So it's not as if, this thing that people remember very fondly and remember as one of these exciting historic moments in pro wrestling over the last 10 years. That was 10 years ago too, by the way. 10 years ago!
Yep.
Can you believe that?
It was the era of Pawn Stars killing it in the ratings.
Yes. Chris Ellner fond of reminding us. Pawn Stars was on top. So it's not like this had immediate positive business results, at least in terms of a TV rating. I'm sure Punk did well in merchandise, but yeah, you don't see the evidence in the TV rating. So what's going to happen now, 10 years later? Is CM Punk this big draw now? Was he not before? And I feel like CM Punk is such a black box to me in terms of trying to assess his economic contributions to a wrestling product, like AEW. I think he'll have, for whatever TV rating effect he has, I think he'll have at least an equal, if not greater effect on things like, pay-per-view buys in terms of, now granted, it's gotta be couched in the right way and he's gonna wrestle Darby Allin. I think you get even more out of the passionate fan in terms of, you know, drawing people into, to watch for free, maybe one thing. And if you want to argue that, well, the casual fans care this much and the hardcore fans care that much, well, then maybe the hardcore fans, maybe they'll pay $50, more so than the general audience is willing to tune in to a wrestling show. But I think something that I never hear really talked about, and I think this is an increasingly relevant phenomenon in wrestling, as wrestling becomes not just about personality. Think about Bruno Sammartino. When was Bruno's prime? The 60s? Am I getting that right?
Yeah. I would say 60s and 70s, but 60s.
And, you know, if we brought, and then they did bring Bruno back in the 80s, and he was, you know, he did some feuds with Randy Savage, I think. My point is, I don't think Bruno Sammartino, this far after his prime, means as much as a lot of wrestlers today mean at the same amount of time past their, I don't know, physical prime or original rise to popularity. Because the 80s, for example, and I feel that maybe Bruno's not the best example, maybe like Luthez is a better example. I don't know. But we didn't have in the 80s all this access to media. We didn't have endless wrestling video libraries available to us. We had what was available in the 80s. I don't even know. I mean, we were barely alive. We might have had Blockbuster, right? You might have had a video store that you could find a very limited selection of wrestling tape. You got access to whatever you got access to on your TV. There was obviously no internet and so forth. And now today, it's so much easier to familiarize yourself and grow a passion for and an affinity for intellectual property, if you will, which I kind of hate to put it that way, intellectual property of wrestlers who are no longer actively performing. So I think another example of this is take Shawn Michaels in the mid-90s, 1996. WWE's not doing great financially in 1996. Shawn Michaels is the champion. He's relatively popular in the WF. He's respected by fans as a great performer. That's his prime. That's what I think of as his prime. And then, of course, he takes his absence, returns in the 2000s. And I would argue he's a far better draw, far bigger draw in the 2000s when he's well into his 40s, than he was in his prime. Because you got all of these people who used to be kids in the mid-90s, let's say. They're adults. They've got spending power now. They're willing to go to WrestleMania and spend a couple $100 or more on a WrestleMania ticket to see him wrestle The Undertaker, for example. Because as time goes on, this nostalgia grows, our ability to access media has exploded, and we're more able to, think about all these remakes that are made for movies, you know? That's different because we're not talking about an athlete here, but like, they're gonna remake Superman and Batman movies forever, you know? And it's almost as time goes on here, no matter how many times they remake these movies, they do bigger and bigger box offices. Who knows what the future of theater going is going to be? I know. But up to this point, that I think that's been the case. Star Wars, all these franchises that are decades old, and they seem to do better business over time. And I think there's some similar effect for wrestling, which is a good thing for wrestling and also a problem for wrestling, because then it tempts you to just go with the pat hand, and especially if you're kind of discomforted by these kids today and these millennials who are kind of trepidatious, it tempts you to, you know, say, you know, all right, I'll give this kid a chance, and then give him a fake chance for 4 or 6 months, and then just go back to what makes you comfortable, and to not really invest in new talent. And new talent has always been the thing that has been associated with the biggest explosions in wrestling business. Whether that was Hulk Hogan in the 80s, Steve Austin and The Rock in the 90s, Antonio Inoki, Giant Baba in the 70s, the Three Musketeers in New Japan in the 90s, Okada in the 2010s. I think we're kind of increasingly living in this time where it's easy to rely on legacy IP, if you will. Legacy is just a euphemism for old, in media business talk, I found. So this is where maybe in some ways there's an important difference between what AEW has at its disposal and WWE has at its disposal. WWE is the company with the multi-decade legacy IP in their access. AEW has 2 years of legacy IP. They have some wrestlers who have been around for a long time, but in terms of a video library, they don't have so much. And maybe that motivates AEW, that doesn't have a huge legacy to fall back on. Maybe that motivates AEW to, I'm overcomplicating this, but maybe that motivates AEW to produce new stars more so than it does WWE. But really, we're just overcomplicating the fact that Vince is an out-to-lunch head of creative, and Tony Khan is simply a competent one, and that's what's happening. But those are the settings in which they're producing wrestling TV, I guess.
Just a couple quick things. First, before we forget out of the TV ratings, Dark Side of the Ring is coming back September 16th. So they will be into the fold. And then also too, Fightful did report this week that TNT was very excited about CM Punk. And I'm assuming that's also other opportunities, as he is a pretty established actor now at this point, especially in the horror and thriller movie circuit. Possibly some crossover there. With WarnerMedia, with him being on that type of series, or I don't know if they still do.
Ratings are great, but what about Synergy?
Yeah. So, Synergy indeed.
Okay. The SmackDown number on Friday, we don't know. I'm not going to venture to guess. There was more NFL preseason programming preempting SmackDown. Not in as many markets as last week. We've only got Fox preempting in, it looks like, Baltimore, Washington, Louisville, and Lexington. We had a lot more markets the previous week. But the prelims...
There was a more Saturday that, games, that's why.
There are more Saturday games?
There's more Saturday. Yeah. But go ahead, sir.
Okay. The prelim rating, which I've learned this is what we have to call it. Not fast affiliate. No one knows what that means, even though that maybe that's the more technical terminology. Not overnight, because there's no reason that anybody thinks that overnight doesn't mean accurate. Right? Preliminary rating. That's the word to use, I think. But the preliminary rating would indicate that from 8 to 10, Fox was being watched by 2.2 million viewers, which would be a pretty big rating for SmackDown. What's SmackDown been doing lately? Let's go to the spreadsheet. SmackDown, the previous week did, about 2.1 million. Week before that, almost 2.2 million. So this is possible, I suppose. 2.1 million. So, I don't know. I know a lot of people have the theory that, people turn their TVs on Friday night, you know, before 10 o'clock and were thinking about wrestling and decided to turn on Fox to see what SmackDown was up to. I did that, but sometimes I do turn on SmackDown regardless, against my own, happiness and interest. But yeah, we'll see. I could see the rating being, it's obviously not going to be the huge difference that it was last week between the prelim and the final. But I imagine it's going to be at least slightly lower. And we'll find out at the same time we find out about the Rampage rating on Friday, or on Monday afternoon.
All right. Just moving on to the Dynamite quarter-hour breakdown. Viewers in the thousands. And if you want to go into deeper in this, but it looks like the P2 highest segment was the final minutes of Rosen Ford, and then Malakai Black video, and then Arn and Brock Anderson interview, as well as a Miro video, and then the first 2 minutes MJF and Chris Jericho. There's also a Moxley promo too, so a lot of promos in that. The highest 18-49 was the first segment, which was Garcia in 2.0 attacking Moxley Kingston, and then the Sting and Darby Allin versus 2.0, as well as the Sammy Guevara engagement.
Yeah, I don't see huge takeaways here to have. I think quarter hours tempt people to hyperanalyze what's happening and to draw conclusions that confirm their biases, but nonetheless, I report them. I do think there is a takeaway to have here about this Thunder Rosa match. Where is that? That's in Q6, the 7 minutes of it, and then the finish in Q9, or Q7, rather. Q7 was the peak of the show in total viewership and was a little bit of an increase. Got pretty consistent 18.49 viewership here, but there's two quarters here that do over a million. It's Q6 and Q7. Those are mainly Q6 mainly consists of the Thunder Rosa and Penelope Ford match, and then the following quarter for 1 minute consisted of the finish. And Q7 is usually the low point. It's more often the low point, I think, than any other quarter. So I think it's encouraging of the idea that the Thunder Rosa is a draw. Yeah.
All right. Moving on. I don't know if you want to go over the 18-49 chart.
No.
Okay, yeah, so you skip
screw
that.
Those line graphs.
All right, yep. All right. We'll go to the live event bar graphs that you have here, starting with the past live events, if you want to break that down.
Yeah. Let's talk about what AEW and WWE have been averaging. Now that we have quite a few shows here, we've got Raw averaging, this is according, all this data is according to WrestleTick's estimate. Raw is averaging over 9,000 tickets distributed. SmackDown is averaging 9,800. I should round these. Raw is averaging 9,100. SmackDown is averaging 9,800. A lot of this is market dependent, to be fair. Super shows, which are euphemisms for house shows, is averaging 6,500, which is pretty good. That's definitely on the high end, and where we are now, we are still in the era of pent up demand, apparently. Dynamite at this moment is averaging about 4,000 even, just under that. 4,000. Rampage, we've only got two examples of Rampage, and those happen to average to 10,000. So, total tickets distributed between the two. WWE, 166,000. AEW at less than a third of that, with 55,000. So there's that. We can talk about the, WrestleTix did put this little table together. The most highly attended AEW shows up to this point in the company's history. Number one is now the United Center, Chicago, August 20th, this past Friday, with 14,376, which edges out the attendance for Washington. This is the debut of Dynamite with 14,129. Yeah. Newark, New Jersey, I think is going to rank number three here, and September 22nd, which is September. Where are they this week? Do you know off the top of your head? Don't worry about it. But Newark is coming up in September, Newark, New Jersey. That'll probably rank number three. And then September 22nd, Arthur Ashe Stadium in New York City will become number one, based on the tickets that are already distributed for that event. Here it is. September 15th is Newark, New Jersey.
They are in Milwaukee.
Oh,
and then followed by the, followed by the, three Chicago shows.
Okay.
With, Dynamite, Rampage, and All Out.
Okay. How loud am I in your earphones right now? I'm just normal. Hearing a little bit of an echo. And now, it's time for the Nick Khan section of the podcast. Nick Khan, have you seen this week? Nick Khan was all over the place. Did you listen to any of the Nick Khan interviews? There's really only one I've listened to at this moment.
I listened to the clip that you sent me, but I saw the tagline on Twitter, open for business! from that interview as well. I'm not sure it was the same interview, but.
And the stock reacted. We've got SB Nation out here pushing the headline. Stock is up 2.5%. S&P 500 just barely above even because Nikon said open for business. And I think he did an interview with Peter Kafka for Recode Media, which I'm going to brag is a podcast that I already listen to. But I don't always listen to it as soon as it comes out. So it had been like a day, since that podcast had published, and somehow I had not seen on Twitter or the internet that that podcast was out there. Missed it by a whole day, but I have listened to it in its entirety. Nikon did for BT Sport, did an interview with Ariel Helwani, his former client. And that might be out there as we record this, but I have not listened to it yet. Where he's, at least it looks like in one clip, trying to temper open for business and trying to, urge people back to sanity. As by the way, can we get an update, Chris Gullo? Has WWE been acquired by a major wrestling company yet? Or by a major media company?
Not yet, but it's a weekend. You never know.
Okay.
Stuff moves slower in the weekend.
Okay. WWE Corporate, by the way, set a new record for the number of press releases put out in a single week. Do you want to go over some of these highlights here? These are excerpts from just a few of the press releases that I got email alerts.
Yeah. First off, WWE 2K22 releases March 2022. By the way, side note on that, did you happen to see the news media clip where they were showing the Taliban take over Afghanistan and one of the cars they were driving had a W2K decal on it?
What?
Yeah, I'll have to send it to you. Yes. I'll have to send it to you. But yeah, so WWE 2K22 releases March 2022. Also, the release regarding Spotify, the Ringer Spotify Studio, and WWE will launch an exclusive audio network as part of a multi-year audio content partnership. The company's announced today as part of the deal, the Ringer and WWE will also collaborate to develop new audio content exclusively for the Spotify platform and the Ringer website. In addition, existing WWE audio programming, which offers a unique look at WWE both in the ring and beyond, will become available exclusive on Spotify, so I'm assuming the New Day podcast, Corey Graves, all that. The Ringer will be expanding its wrestling coverage. The current feed for the show, The Masked Man Show, hosted by David Shoemaker and Kaz, will rebrand to The Ringer Wrestling Show and will continue on that feed alongside new programming from WWE personalities. Together, The Ringer and WWE will collaborate on a new original podcast series, including a series from WWE personality Evan Mack, Mackmania, and a narrative series by Bill Simmons. Utilizing Spotify Green Room, hosts will be going live after every major WWE pay-per-view, with the final rooms becoming podcasts for the Ringer Wrestling Show.
Go
on.
So I don't really have any idea how much this is worth. And by the way, I heard some cynicism and misunderstanding here that this would be a deal that WWE is paying Spotify for the exposure or something, which I'm almost certain is not what's happening here. This is a licensing deal. Okay. All these things that we're about to talk about here are the array of licensing opportunities that Nikon is capitalizing on for WWE. How much they are all worth, probably what stock analysts call incremental revenue, small increases compared to same year prior, or same period prior year. It is something that at least on one earnings call I remember being brought up by an analyst. You know, when are you going to make a deal in the podcasting space? Seems like the WWE would be a good fit for that. So not a huge surprise that they would do this. They're probably getting something for it.
Spotify's been very aggressive with acquiring exclusive content, such as the Joe Rogan deal. So
yeah. Oh, good time to make our disclosures here. I have Spotify shares. You have WWE shares.
I do. I no longer have WWE shares.
You're out.
I'm out. Sell? I bought more. More Dogecoin. A week and a half ago.
When you were really putting over how valuable WWE is as a company, was that when you sold them? Remember that when you were like, man, this company is great.
I you'll have to find the audio clips for that. but It wasn't moving much, so I ended up selling it. And then I saw Dogecoin was really low, and I'm like, yeah, I might as well just go all in. And Dogecoin has been doing absolutely awesome. Like, it has been on a big increase.
Let me get this straight. You cashed out on WWE. Did you make a gain, by the way?
Very small gain.
Okay. Big gain, small gain.
Yeah.
So Chris Gullo made some money on WWE, full disclosure. But then he liquidated and transferred that capital over to the Doge. So
Doge fell to 19 and it's at 31 cents right now. So,
okay. Wonderful. Replica belts.
Yes. So, MLB replica belts in a multi-year partnership to create MLB-inspired WWE Championship title belts and accessories featuring the logos of all 30 Major League Baseball clubs from around North America. The new line of merchandise launches in 2022, marking the first time these items have been available for fans. This is the first official licensing agreement for WWE Championship title belts between WWE and the other major sports leagues. As part of the agreement, MLB and WWE will collaborate to design and manufacture team-branded belts, as well as belts that collaborate some of the league's jewel events, such as the World Series, All-Star Game, and Home Run Derby. Additionally, the two sides will create custom side plates and unique Lucha Libre masks.
This is something that Nick Khan hyped, not in the most recent earnings call, but in the one before that, in May, that they had a deal with a major sports league coming. And here it is. More on jewel events later in the program.
I would imagine that some other leagues probably fall through this and do this as well. You know, the men will be one up. I mean, the replica belts people talk about all the time when the players were having for the Super Bowl and stuff. So,
yes, as I say often, if you want to know why WWE Championship belts are now just giant WWE logos that people strap around their belly buttons, that's why. So that everybody sees the WWE logo. NFTs.
Yeah, we had the John Cena SummerSlam Gold NFT with the new Super Mario inspired logo that was going at 1,000. And then we had the John Cena SummerSlam 21 Platinum. This title belt looked like it was almost a spinner title NFT. That was at 21,000, and that auction ended. But we still have you could still buy one of the limited edition SummerSlam 2021 John Cena digital cards.
So, these, you can still get a John Cena NFT for $1,000. I know they put a lot of, bells and whistles on this, like tickets and whatnot. But yeah, the single item one, $21,000. They decided to go with this offering of, the limited edition and the one item, as opposed to there were the Undertaker NFTs at WrestleMania. There were three different. I think there was a gold, silver, platinum, or something like that, bronze. Maybe there were four. So this is a more limited offering. And, NFTs seem to have cooled off, which, I should have looked this up beforehand, but what was the inventory to begin with on these John Cena limited edition items that there's still 454, items left of, so not selling out, maybe reflective of NFTs not being as much of a craze anymore.
All right. We will move on. Just have a couple highlights of the week. We already talked about the NFTs, but the article from Sportico, if you want to get into that.
John Wall Street from Sportico did an article where he had some comments from Nick Khan, basically hyping up all these things that we're talking about here in terms of what WWE has done to improve their product licensing line, which is a line that they make well over $40 million of revenue in a given year. I think Nick Khan was hyping to John Wall Street that, you know, this is a line of revenue that has really grown. And if you compare this to Q2 2019, non-pandemic, it's up 20%. I do buy the idea that a lot of that may have to do with things that that Nikon is doing in terms of monetizing IP in different ways that have not been happening before for WWE. So I provided some numbers to John Wall Street to help him understand what the difference really was in revenue over time.
Just real quick, there was 500 NFTs of those gold limited edition cards. And it was also the logo and everything they were using on the limited edition merchandise that you can get for... Yeah, these were limited edition Super Mario John Cena merchandise. So
they only sold 46 out of 500 of these.
Yeah, right? And Yahoo Finance said they were listing 500 of these NFTs.
Jesus. All right. Moving on.
All right. We got an announcement that Money in the Bank 2022 will be at Allegiant Stadium. Pretty big stadium for a Money in the Bank event, and that will be July 4th, 2022.
Yes. Back to Nick Khan's hometown. July 4th for ratings has always been a bad time for WWE ratings. So I wonder how that will be reflected in the ticket sales might not be as affected. Maybe the viewership, though. But they'll only tell us the viewership probably in a term of percent difference. And if it's not a favorable delta, then they probably won't tell us at all. So, but yeah, again, the days of knowing what pay-per-views do in terms of media on an individual basis are increasingly behind us.
The news you've been waiting for, Brandon. When is Crown Jewel coming back? And it will be back in October of this year. They really hooked it up on that promo package last night when I was watching. Yeah.
Both this and the video game, W2K22 announcement, about the video game too. This was expected, I believe, to be out in the fall. The video game was supposed to be out in the fall, after, they postponed it and came out with, Battleground, right? Battlegrounds. The sort of,
Battlegrounds.
Arcade style game. So pushing this all the way back to the early spring, to March, is interesting. And that's going to affect, W revenues. You know, usually W gets, in Q3 and Q4, probably both from the release and the timing of the release being a few months before the holidays. WWE's not going to have a new console game to put out. So, I don't know. Maybe some of these deals that Nikon is making to monetize the IP will offset some of that postponed revenue. Crown Jewel. Chris Gull, how much does WWE make from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia every time they go to Saudi Arabia?
Might be wrong on the total. $46 million. I know it's in that range.
$50 million.
$50 million. Okay, 46 for some reason is sticking out to me. I don't know why.
Yeah.
$50 million.
So it just so happens that Brock Lesnar and Bill Goldberg are back in town for WWE. I'm sorry. Did we say Saudi Arabia?
Yeah.
I meant large scale international event. Excuse me.
Oh yeah.
Yes. And it's interesting to note that Brock Lesnar and Becky Lynch are both apparently on SmackDown, with Brock Lesnar coming out to do a confrontation with Roman Reigns, who's on SmackDown, and Becky Lynch coming out to win the SmackDown women's title. Both of those returning talents going to Fox, not Raw, not USA.
Just in time for the season premiere, which will probably be in a few weeks, as Fox likes to put on when they come back in September.
That's right.
Not when they come back, but they're usually their first or second September show. Mm-hmm. All right. So, yeah, you want to talk about some comments from these Nick Khan. And we'll first start with media deals that Nick Khan is especially interested in.
Yeah, we've got a long clip here from the Peter Kafka interview he did on the Recode Media podcast. So here's this week, Nick Khan talking to Peter Kafka.
Be positive about the future of rights for this kind of stuff you're making. That said, we're having this back and forth now for years about sports, but all content in general. Is the value of this stuff going to keep going up and up and up, or eventually are the networks, the streamers, whomever, going to say, we've reached a top, it's no longer makes economic sense for us to pay for this stuff, and or we can get a lot of this stuff much cheaper? How are you thinking about how that landscape is going to evolve?
I think that what you're seeing a little bit of, or what we may see a little bit of, is that the relative middle class of sports rights. So again, we're speaking relative terms here, that may get squeezed a little bit. So I'm curious to see what happens with Major League Soccer's deal. You know, the NFL obviously came during the pandemic, mm-hmm. and, you know, kicked ass in terms of what they were able to get. That's no surprise. The NBA is coming up in a couple of years, even with ratings a touch down. We think the NBA is going to be in great shape. You saw, and again, with the disclosure that I was part of the process on the Southeastern Conference, they got big numbers for their package, which they deserve all of that and more. I'm curious to see what happens with the Big 12, especially with Oklahoma and Texas going to the SEC. Curious to see what happens with the Pac-12. You know, do those sort of fall into the middle bucket now, or do they stay top?
Because we've seen the rights go up and up and up year after year after year, and the ratings were kind of constant. And for a long time, we were told, well, it's still, even if everything else is slowing down, sports is impervious to the drop we're seeing across the rest of the cable and TV universe. Now those have started to drop as well. And now the argument is, well, they're dropping, but it's still the only place you can reach these really big audiences, and that justifies it. And or, well, if you want to start a new streaming thing, you got to have this tentpole thing. But eventually, everyone will have launched whatever they're going to launch. If the tech guys are going to get in, they'll have gotten in. It seems like maybe the Asia is the next sort of argument, like, oh, this will work really well internationally. It does seem like eventually you can't keep arguing that this thing, which has less people watching in it than it did 10 years ago, is worth X amount more.
I think you've seen it in primetime scripted television, if you will. So again, when you and I were kids and Archie Bunker did a 15 rating.
Mm-hmm.
And made significant amount of money at that time for Norman Lear and the studio and everybody behind it. Now you're seeing shows in primetime that do a 1 in the demo, where significant dollars are paid for that. So 1/15th, and again, the 15 million was the overall audience, but even less than 1/15th of what the audience was 30 years ago, still commanding top dollar. So I'm not sure that you've seen a mechanism come across for advertisers yet that is as effective as television, and put the streaming component in there on the ad-supported tiers. It feels like it's going to be around at a high level for a long time.
And the other argument you hear, and I was talking with the guys from Men in Blazers about this, is that even the smaller stuff with passionate audiences actually remains super relevant to the streamers, because if Peacock is going to work, it's not because everyone's going to watch WWE. It's because a couple million people are going to come for that, and someone else is going to come for Premier League, and someone else is going to come for The Office. That's the premise. You need a handful. Maybe they're not all anchor tenants, but they all bring an audience with them.
Truly. And by the way, I listened to the podcast with Michael and Roger on it. Those guys are as across this stuff, in my opinion, in terms of knowing where it was, where it is, and where it'll head, as I'd like to think we might be. It's the smaller sports have made even more of an imprint, because to get unique subscribers, you need something unique. And I think that's what a lot of these properties have to offer.
So there's Nick Kahn, again, talking to Peter Kafka on one of my favorite podcasts, non-wrestling podcasts. So what they're getting at there a little bit is how the middle class of TV rights fees might be affected in time. What I hear people yell at me about sometimes is that the media sports rights bubble is going to burst. You know, how much longer can they really continue to get all these increases in TV rights fees? I'm more optimistic that they'll continue to be able to get high TV rights fees, in part for reasons that Nick Kahn is talking about here, where he talked about the demo too, by the way. He talked about the demo. That matters. The demo he's referring to almost certainly is the P18 to 49 demo. We've got, you know, the top programs on broadcast are doing about a 1.0 in the demo, which he points out is a 15th of what top programs were doing 30 years ago. But the ad mechanism is very effective, and you got streaming starting to come in with their own ad tier, including Peacock. But he's very interested to see how the MLS, the soccer rights, go. He's interested to see how the Big 12 goes, those TV deals for college football. And he's clearly positioning the NFL and the NBA as in the upper class of sports rights. What's conspicuous here, though, is where does he, and is not touched on in this clip or in the interview, overall, where does he view WWE sports rights? He's clearly publicly optimistic about WWE's ability to garner increasing media rights values over time. And I suspect he is privately, but it seems possible that WWE is in the middle class of sports rights, which means that there is uncertainty about the ability for that class of sports rights to grow over time, which is interesting, to say the least.
All right. And then we got a nice little chart of the gauge of, and this is from Nielsen. It's a total TV and streaming snapshot, which is really interesting. And this is, you know, in a total day with two or more people in a house and the breakdown in, cable still doing 38%, but, streaming 28%, broadcast 24%, and then other was under 10%.
Yes. So, as everyone knows, Chris Gullo, no one watches linear TV anymore. Just old people, which this is not broken down by age. But here we have the majority of TV watch time. This is called Nielsen's Total TV and Streaming Snapshot. So I think this means not just television and set watching, but this would, I read to include mobile devices and tablets as well, and laptops and computers, etc. Yet here we have what's 24 plus 38%. That is, let's see, 42 plus 20 is 62% is happening through either cable or broadcast, what we call linear TV. For those that don't know, broadcast TV just means your basic channels like ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, CW. Majority still happening through linear TV. When I've got young people, probably anonymous teenagers with avatar profile photos telling me that the ratings don't matter, and I would like to see the YouTube numbers about this, because nobody watches linear TV anymore. Now, granted, yes, this is going to change over time, and I'm sure it has been changing over time, that streaming is occupying a greater portion of this pie chart, and will continue to occupy a larger portion of this pie chart over time. But the majority of TV watching is still through linear TV. People age 2 and above. So there's that. I wanted to talk too, though, related to this, about why P2 Plus matters. Cause I had a discussion with Joe Lanza, and he has had a discussion about our discussion. So I just wanted to expand on my thoughts about why. Yes, the demo matters. The demo matters to Tony Khan, to Nick Khan, to everybody, to Stephanie McMahon. She mentioned it too recently, right? 18 to 49 is what sells a lot of the ads. Nobody buys ads based on P2 Plus. But I don't buy this idea that P2 Plus doesn't matter and shouldn't matter to anybody in particular. I know AEW, Tony Khan and AEW only care about the key demo, but I don't understand why. P2 Plus, Chris Gullo, do you have cable?
I do not.
What do you have? Do you have just streaming services?
Streaming services, and I may or may not use someone's cable login to log into networks streaming services.
Okay, I'm going to call the FBI. But anyway, a lot of people, 80 million people in this country, still subscribe to cable and satellite. That's declining, but that's 80 million people. And if there's anybody listening here who has a cable subscription, you know that that's not cheap. And you know the customer service is probably terrible. And there's terrible communication about what the different offerings are, and it's difficult to get out of your bill or your contract or whatever, because it's not in their interest to make this easy and free of friction for you. They want you to not think about changing your plan, trimming it down, or canceling it, because these cable businesses or satellite businesses, in the case of DirecTV and Dish Network, are very profitable businesses. They're businesses that are gradually declining, but they're profitable businesses. Netflix is a profitable business. You know, it's not a profitable business. Peacock. You know, it is a profitable business. Xfinity, Comcast. So when we talk about the advertising, and this relates to the key demo, right? Nobody buys an ad based on the P2 Plus rating. Absolutely. People buy ads based on the demo ratings of 18 to 49 or some other demo. That's nice for a cable network. Cable networks make money through selling ads that air during their programs. You know where cable networks make more of their money, though? You know where they make the most of the majority of their money? Not through ads. Through carriage fees that they charge cable systems like DirecTV and Dish Network and Spectrum and Comcast Xfinity, T TNT charges those carriers to carry Turner networks. That makes up the majority of the revenue. That makes up about two-thirds of the revenue. You know what makes about one-third of their revenue? Ads. You know what's supporting this profitable system? People, everybody over the age of two that lives in a household that uses a linear TV subscription. You know what the most popular video service is in the United States? It's not Netflix. It's not Hulu. It's not Disney Plus. It's not HBO Max. It's not YouTube. It's the linear TV bundle that people pay not $9.99 a month for, that people pay, you know, upwards of $100 a month in some cases for, depending on what your tier is and what your package is. And I know there's internet bundled in there and phone, etc. But this is a huge business, and it's a profitable business. It is a declining business, and that's why all of these media companies are scrambling to get a streaming service to catch the shrinking profits that they're still making off of cable TV. They need a lifeboat to transfer these declining profits from. But let's talk about P50 Plus. Even though, yeah, there's these P50 Plus people that, and, you know, tons of them watch Raw and NXT and Blue Bloods and God knows what else, Fox News, and their ad eyeballs are not worth nearly as much as people in 18 to 49. That's true. But you know what people over the age of 50, how they also contribute to TV? They pay their cable bills every month. Okay. And if they're over the age of 50, what's the life expectancy in this country? It's about 78, right? They're not going to die within the term of, most of them are not going to die in the term of a wrestling contract, a wrestling TV contract, which is four years in the case of AEW with the option. And it's 5 years in the case of WWE. So this idea that one should only care about the demo, I don't understand. And, if total viewership doesn't matter, then sure, I guess I can understand why the wrestling companies, for example, or the NFL would talk about P2 Plus, because that's the bigger number than 18 to 49, even though perhaps I would tend to agree that the 18 to 49 is more valuable. But what I don't understand and don't agree with is the notion that P2 Plus just doesn't matter. It's the bigger number to offer in PR. But then you still got media journalists like John Oran from the Sports Business Journal who talk about total viewership far more often than they talk about 18 to 49. They talk about 18 to 49 sometimes too, but they talk about total viewership as well. Why does WWE put P2 Plus in their key performance indicator slides? Their P18 to 49 is far more exceptional in the greater landscape of television viewing, yet they put P2 Plus in their slides. If AEW wants to only ever negotiate in the United States with Turner, and if Turner truly just totally dismisses P2 Plus, let's assume that that's true, and that they only care about what happens for viewers between the ages of 18 to 49, great. But I don't know that that's the strategy of every other TV network in the United States. And is AEW just sort of surrendering to this idea that they're never going to do business with anybody outside of the Turner universe or the Warner Media / Discovery universe? Wouldn't it behoove them to be valuable to other potential suitors? Or maybe it's just the case that AEW never sees itself broadcasting outside of the Warner Media / Discovery space in the future, because the long game is maybe just to be acquired by that company in the end. So I think that's my view on it. And I think it's our job to not just relay the thoughts of the executives in wrestling, but to scrutinize how they look at the media business and look at their business. And I don't know, to question why they look at it that way when it doesn't make sense when I look at the total picture. But I'm more than happy to be corrected, and I'll relent if we can find, some other examples of people who are not employed by AEW or talking directly to people at AEW who are as big a champions of this notion that P2 Plus doesn't matter. I only care about the key demo. I love you, Joe Lanza.
All right. Yeah. So, we have some comments from Triple H from the tryouts, which just a note on WWE tryouts. There were some independent talents signed, but they were mostly connected to a wrestling school, such as Booker T's. I know the one, woman who was a Las Vegas native, she had experience on WOW Women of Wrestling, but hasn't wrestled in 2 years. On a match, but not the usual indie names you hear getting signed out of things like this. But Triple H was asked a question regarding the direction NXT.
Here's Triple H. As we kind of discussed last week, is Triple H going to do a media conference call like he always does before the takeovers? Is he going to take questions from the media in this environment? And the answer is no. Well, okay, he will, but trial questions only, okay? So here's Triple H talking in Las Vegas to the wrestling media about the tryout. And this is this clip comes from Ariel Helwani. I don't know who's asking the question, though. We don't hear the question, but he's talking about – he seems to be alluding to the idea that there's been news reports out there about how the developmental philosophy in WWE is changing. We've heard reports that Vince wrote a memo or something to somebody saying no more midgets, and he wants tall people and young people, and as opposed to maybe people on the indies or something. So here's Triple H seeming to address that.
Funny thing, people talk about the shifting of what it is. It never really shifted. Right? So if you go back and you look at the hiring process, not hiring process of a television show, hiring process of who we were looking to train and make WWE superstars, mm-hmm. right? Long term. If you go back and you look at that, it hasn't shifted. It's been the same process. I don't negate anybody, right? And from a standpoint of like, well, I wrestle some independent stuff. Well, all right, you're out. You know, like it. That's not a factor to me.
So there's Triple H Paul Levesque, saying nothing's different here. Everything's the same. There's nothing different. This reminds me of this one time when I was it was the late 90s, and my friend and I were big wrestling fans, and I went over to his house, and I was probably 13, 12, something like that, and it's probably like 98, right? So wrestling is getting pretty popular, and his mom was leaving to go somewhere and was leaving us home alone, and she told us that we were not allowed to wrestle each other in the living room, which we clearly wanted to do and had done in the past or something. So as soon as she left, we started to throw each other around with our version of professional wrestling in the living room. She saw this commotion from the car as she was pulling out of the driveway, pulled back in, stormed back in the house, and screamed her head off at us. And we were like, no, we weren't doing anything. We weren't doing anything. There's nothing different here. We weren't doing anything. And that's what this clip reminded me of.
What I think you understand too, it's not just people are questioning the direction of, you know, obviously what they're going for as signings, but just let's look at tonight, for example. You know, Las Vegas has a ton of suitable sized arenas connected to the casinos where they could have had takeover. But where is it? It's at the Capitol Wrestling.
That's right.
They're devaluing their own interest in the, like, to the fans. Like, it's not like the fans are like, oh, I don't want, like, you know, there was a lot of independent shows this weekend in Las Vegas. I'm sure you would have garnered a pretty good crowd for Adam Cole versus Kyle O'Reilly.
Yeah. It's interesting. The lack of any attempt at doing a live event, beyond the Performance Center. Well, by the way, I think it was maybe it was The Observer that reported that the relationship with Full Sail is over. Since they're not even doing that. But you can see the cost savings. Why pay to be at Full Sail when you can just run it out of the PC and you already have the overhead on the PC anyway. But yeah, unless they just think that these events that they would run, whether it's a takeover event or even sort of the national tour, I understand they don't want, I've heard people, say that they can't do the Florida loop because, the idea that the Delta variant is out here and there's so many unvaccinated people in Florida. But whatever the case, you would think that, and those Florida Loop events are probably not profitable. I think they're more likely to not be profitable because those are very small audiences of just a few hundred, right? But I wonder why not attempt to do the house shows on a national tour like they used to do. And maybe those wouldn't be very profitable either. But even that, so let's take it to a third level here, as you're saying here, Gullo, why not try to do a takeover? We've got over 45,000 people in Allegiant Stadium for this show. Maybe the idea that you wouldn't get that many because it's a Sunday instead of the Saturday before, and people are more likely to leave because the big event has already happened. But
yeah, but you're in a city with so many suitable sized venues, 5,000 seat arenas and stuff like that. You're in a lot of, like, you could have did something.
It's
like
almost
that.
As if they don't want it to succeed anymore. Yeah. Or you know.
Yeah, they're devaluing interest. They are devaluing interest in their product, like on purpose. It almost seems like. Mm-hmm. And then I've noticed. I don't know if you. I don't know if you're not paying much attention to it, but 205 Live is pretty much became their B show for NXT. Like, it's not really cruiserweights. It's just like younger guys from NXT wrestling.
Josh
on there.
Briggs is out there.
They don't. Joe Gacy wrestled, like, guys like that, like, that they're not featuring very strong in NXT TV, but they're on the NXT roster. So it's pretty much became the main event of NXT.
Yeah. And just some thoughts on developmental, generally. I think what we see happening in AEW, granted, AEW, I know AEW's viewership is about half of what Raw and SmackDown's is. But AEW's viewership is certainly bigger than NXT, which is maybe developmental now. Are we officially acknowledging it as developmental? So AEW is something more than developmental. It's something that is attracting a TV rights fee of about $44 million a year. NXT is attracting something far less than that. And AEW stands in a position to, I think at this moment, if all things are equal in a couple of years from now, to get a multiplication of its TV rights values, in the future. But anyway, my point is, this is not developmental. This is really lucrative television. And you've got people, on AEW TV, talent on AEW TV that I can only imagine if they were in the WWE system would not be in a similar comparable position in WWE right now. I'm thinking of the MJFs, the Darby Allins, and more recently, Daniel Garcia's, who, disclosure, we trained Daniel Garcia at Grapplers, but it just speaks to this sort of mythical idea that you need to be in developmental, even if you're an indie guy, to be there for, you know, maybe a few years before we can really say that you're ready. And it just slows down the process, I think, of star development, in that you're going to have this person sit down here in developmental because you think they're not prepared or something. It doesn't make sense to me. Besides the fact that you've got somebody who doesn't know how to evaluate talent very well at the top anyway, who's probably going to squander them, especially if they're not very tall. It's such an expose of WWE developmental that we're seeing before our eyes in just the TV that AEW is putting out. I believe that the Indies and Japan and Mexico and the whole non-WWE industry, which is free of any internal cost to any wrestling company, by the way, is a better developmental system than the one WWE spends millions of dollars to uphold. You can put Division I athletes, or you can put non-Division I athletes like MJF and Darby Allin and Daniel Garcia on TV without having them do compound movements in a $1 million facility, or, you know, housing them for 2 to 5 years before they move up to the main roster. It's like the whole notion that, WWE developmental, it proves to be more about reinforcing, I think, in effect, more about reinforcing a hierarchy, and more about reinforcing their supposed unquestionable wisdom, and they're sort of holding their nose arrogance about, you know, the indies that comes from the incumbent class of executives and legendary veterans. It's more about that than it is about preparing wrestlers to truly become stars that draw money, brother. When they're just going to take that talent and, you know, graduate them up to a creative environment that's not going to know how to evaluate them well or tell sensible long-term stories that are going to be in the best interest of cultivating their star power anyway.
All right. With that, it's SummerSlam happened, and can you get everything on WWE, that WWE Network had on Peacock? I don't think so.
Yeah, let's see. This might break our test stream here. But there is a Twitter account, somebody running a Twitter account that has been keeping an Excel spreadsheet that I will display on the screen. And we are at, as of, I think this is yesterday. So yesterday was SummerSlam. 92% of the titles that were on the standalone WWE network are now on Peacock. Most of what's missing are the hidden gems. There's basically no hidden gems on there. There's, as of yesterday, one episode of SmackDown missing out of the 1,100 episodes of SmackDown. What else is missing? There are some things in the originals category that are missing. 80% of that is there. But 10,282 titles out of 11,125 have made it to Peacock. Most of it is there, including a lot of the territorial stuff. But some of it is not.
All right. And then, did we touch on last week that report surfacing that a couple years ago that WWE did try to buy CMLL? I can't remember if we touched on that last week or not.
I don't know. We probably,
cause I know it was out there last week. I know they talked about it last week at Figure Four Weekly.
Was that an
observer? It was just due to the arena. I think it was Figure Four. Yeah. I think it was kind of rehashing what Dave brought up in 2019. But, let's see here. I know they mentioned it in Figure Four Weekly and, that got a little bit of traction, but this hasn't happened in a couple of years.
Is there still a Figure Four Weekly,
Well, it's just Figure Four Weekly Online. I'm not sure. It says it's credit to Figure4WeeklyOnline.com. Yeah, but while not known, there were a few talks a few years back, of WWE buying CMLL. WWE wanted to run Mexico with the idea it could get the cream of the crop talent in Mexico and then groom some of them for the U.S. market. The belief was that if they owned CMLL and got all the top talent, that AAA wouldn't be able to keep its talent and they would have the best of both. Where the deal fell apart was CMLL to sell. They wanted selling the arenas as part of the deal, and WWE didn't want to own so many older arenas.
WWE did not want to own Arena Mexico and Arena Coliseo.
Yeah.
Buildings too, but yeah.
It was something Dave originally reported a couple years back, but I found it interesting that they just came down the pike recently. Remember Nick Khan said in his interview.
Yeah. In the interview we did with Colin Cowherd where he mentions that they're interested in expanding into Mexico, not that they want to acquire either of the two companies, alluding to AAA and CMLL. So maybe that's what he had in mind, some knowledge that WWE was in 2019 before Nick Khan was in the company that they had discussed that. Yeah.
All right. Any other final news and notes?
Nope. I think this is going to be the longest episode we've ever done.
Yes. Probably. And now it's time for plugs.
Yes.
I'll just.
You go first.
Yeah, I'll just plug myself real quick. Chris Gello, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, more importantly, Rediscovering the Indies, the other podcast I do. I'm a co-host of RTI Pod on Twitter, Rediscovering Indies on Instagram and Facebook. We are launching a brand new episode on Wednesday. We're breaking down the history of the NWA title and a lot of NWA ownership news from 2007 to 2017. Now, this is going to be a multi-parter, much like the XPWs were. So this first part covers a lot of fun stuff, though. The end of the relationship with TNA, you know, what happened, why it dissolved. We cover the NWA getting a TV deal with a Colors TV on the Dish Network. We cover NWA launching their own Mexican promotion to compete with AAA and CMLL, NWA Mexico, as well as the very weird relationship with Ring of Honor when using their champion on the shows. And then we also cover the Phillips Arena show that only drew 2,000 people. And the Phillips Arena is huge. So we cover that and so much more in just a first part, which will definitely be a multi-part. We haven't even gotten to Bruce Tharp goodness yet. So yeah, that comes out this Wednesday, Rediscovering the Indies.
Okay, you can go to WrestleNomics.com for resources and articles. You can go to Patreon.com/WrestleNomics, where for just $5 a month you can get my TV ratings reports every weekday, as well as access to the WrestleNomics viewership spreadsheet, as well as other things that are sprinkled about for our subscribers for just $5 a month. You are already listening to this podcast, so thank you. You can follow me on Twitter at WrestleNomics or at Brandon Thurston. I have given Chris Gull access to the Instagram for WrestleNomics. I've got to give him some more images to post there. You can follow us on Instagram at WrestleNomics. I think that's it. I'll probably do a stream Monday evening, which you might be listening to this before then, so you can check that out on YouTube. We'd like you to subscribe to the WrestleNomics channel on YouTube. So I think that's all for this week. Thank you for listening. Thank you to our subscribers for subscribing. We'll talk to you next time. I'm Brandon Thurston.
I'm Chris Gullo.
We'll talk to you next time.